is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Big Picture. Today, we're going to cover a topic that is very much in the news this week, the price of oil and gasoline. And just to bring you up to date, the cost of gas has risen lately to a national average of $2.84 for regular and $3.40 for premium. And we haven't even hit the summer driving season when demand escalates. So the question is, could higher oil prices derail the chances for a second half recovery that economists are hoping for? Let's talk about the possibilities. Last year, when the Trump administration announced pulling out of the Iranian deal, and that was put in place by President Obama, and also that sanctions would be restored, the result was a rise in the price of oil from around $50 a barrel to their peak of $76 a barrel in October of last year. Now, this week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced that the waivers granted last November would not be extended. Those waivers will expire on May 2nd. And by the way, let's listen in to what Pompeo said.
After withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal, President Trump implemented the strongest pressure campaign in history against the Islamic Republic of Iran. The goal remains simple: to deprive the outlaw regime of the funds it has used to destabilize the Middle East for four decades and incentivize Iran to behave like a normal country. Up to 40% of the regime's revenue comes from oil sales. It's the regime's number one source of cash. Before our sanctions went into effect, Iran would generate as much as $50 billion annually in oil revenue. Overall, to date, we estimate that our sanctions have denied the regime well north of $10 million. The regime would have used that money to support terror groups like Hamas and Hezbollah and continue its missile development in defiance of UN Security Council Resolution 2231. And it would have perpetuated the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Our goal has been to get countries to cease importing Iranian oil entirely. Last November, we granted exemptions from our sanctions to seven countries and to Taiwan. With this is to give our allies and partners to wean themselves off of Iranian oil and to assure a well-supplied oil market. Today, I'm announcing that we will no longer grant any exemptions. We're going to zero across the board. We will continue to enforce sanctions and monitor compliance. Any nation or entity interacting with Iran should do its diligence and err on the side of caution. The risks are simply not going to be worth the benefits.
Now, Jim, I don't know about you, but it seems like we're following a similar pattern to last year since the price of crude is over $66 this week. And that's a price higher than where oil prices began last year at this time before the announcement of the waivers. So is another oil shock like the one we experienced last year about to be repeated? What will be the consequences of rising oil prices on the market and the economy? Will we see another repeat of what we went through last October through December?
You know, if you look at what's already happened since Trump walked away from their Iranian deal last year, as you just pointed out, at one point, Iranian oil production was roughly about 3.8 million barrels a day. At the beginning of this year, it was down around 1 million barrels to 2.7 million. So we've already seen 1 million barrels being taken off the market. You add that to the OPEC production cuts of 1.2 million. Chris, you're talking about 2.2 million barrels that have been taken off the market. So many countries like Japan, Italy, and South Korea have already begun reducing their imports of Iranian oil. So already, the impact of U.S. sanctions is being felt. Iranian exports have fallen from their peak to around 2.3 million barrels to currently 1.3 million barrels. So think about it. 2.2 million barrels has been taken out of the market. 1 million from Iran, and then 1.2 million from the OPEC cuts. It's also estimated that if the full waivers go into effect, you could see Iranian oil production drop anywhere from 300,000 barrels a day to 700,000. So it can be said it is definitely going to drop another, let's say, several hundred thousand barrels a day. So in effect, you can have 2.5 million barrels a day. Now, if you We'll play a clip here later on in that press conference, because I think one of the journalists asked, hey, if you're not going to grant waivers and OPEC is cutting back production, where's the difference going to be made up? But we'll talk about that later on.
You know, I really wish I had filled up the tank before Pompeo made that announcement. I'm just behind the eight ball on that type of thing. But Jim, as you heard in that clip, and I've heard this with other, you know, whenever there's an announcement about this sort of thing, there's a warning that goes with it about countries getting Iranian oil. What about compliance with those sanctions? And as I recall, there have been several states that will not go along with those sanctions.
You know, the key is probably the big players, Chris. You talk about the oil markets, the big players are Japan, India, and China. Japan has already reduced their imports because of close economic and military alliance with the U.S., but it's really doubtful that the Chinese will be in full compliance. I mean, they're the second largest economy in the world, and that economy runs on oil. That sort of further complicates the negotiating end of this trade war that we're having with the U.S. India can sort of get around some of the sanctions by paying for oil in its own currency, but India's imports from Iran have already dropped by 40,000 or 400,000 barrels and are expected to drop even further. Turkey is probably one they said they are going to ignore the sanctions, and we'll get into when we talk about the political ramifications of a possible Middle East war when it comes to Turkey. So what we can say is this, it's going to tighten the oil markets further. That is why some analysts are already calling for $80 Brent oil, a price that the Saudis would like to see to balance their budget, which would mean WTI hits the mid-70s again before this is all over. Pretty much, Chris, the script that we were on last year at this time.
Now, Jim, I know the president has tweeted that he wants to see OPEC increase oil production, since he doesn't want to see oil prices rise any further than they already have, especially in an election year. We're just a little over 500 days from the election. And not to mention that the president knows higher gas prices act as a tax on the economy. It impacts the pocketbooks of every American. But in Pompeo's press conference this week, he inferred that the State Department was working with key allies to increase production if the oil market tightens significantly with sanctions. I want to play that clip now.
The United States has been in constant discussion with allies and partners to help them transition away from Iranian crude to other alternatives. And we've been working with major oil-producing countries to ensure the market has sufficient volume to minimize the impact on pricing. Both the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have assured us they will ensure an appropriate supply for the markets. And, of course, the United States is now a significant producer as well.
Now, Jim, what do you think the chances are that that happens after what Trump did last year by granting waivers after he talked key producers like the Saudis to increase oil production?
Quite honestly, I don't think after what happened last year with the granting and waivers, they're going to be in any hurry to increase production anytime soon, no matter what the president tweets. Most likely what you're going to see, OPEC, or really when we're talking about OPEC, it's really Saudi Arabia, will probably wait to see if Iranian oil production actually falls and the sanctions are actually working before moving to increase production. So that's why you're still seeing the price of oil move, because one of the big questions is when OPEC meets, I think it's June, will they sort of do away with the production cuts or maybe cut those production cuts in half from maybe 1.2 down to 600,000? I mean, Saudi Arabia alone could probably fill the gap. But even if Saudi increases production, let's say in the 500 to maybe the 700,000 barrel a day, you got to remember a good portion of the increase is going to be needed for electricity during the summer heat months. Saudi Arabia really finds itself in a very difficult position of having an alliance with Russia, who they've brought in to reduce oil supplies and drive up the price of oil, but also having an alliance with the U.S. to increase supplies. And as they have stated, they need, and analysts have stated, Saudi Arabia needs $80 Brent oil to balance their budget. If I was, Chris, a betting man, I believe we're more likely to see $80 Brent. I believe we're heading in that same direction as last year towards higher oil prices. I mean, we're only about $5 away from $80 Brent, and we may actually surpass that before increased production from OPEC kicks in. Remember, when this happens, they're going to wait and see. The sanctions expire May 2nd, so they're not going to do anything before that. In the meantime, the oil markets are tightening as we head into key summer driving season. It's why you and I are going through what I call gasoline shock in California, where the price of Supreme is well over a $4.30 I paid the other day. And I think regular is close to $4. And remember, it's not just what's going on with Saudi Arabia and Iran. It's also falling Venezuelan production, Libya. All major producers are experiencing political turmoil.
Well, and what does this all mean for the economy? Because if you look at, for example, global economies, investment markets, it's got to have an impact just across the board. Wall Street is betting on a second half recovery now that the Fed's taken the year off. And in fact, I was noting that futures markets are, they seem to be anticipating rate cuts by the end of the year. Have you noticed that, Jim?
Yep. There's a lot of anticipation and suppositions that have been put into this market. What if they don't play out? Now, one of the key things that happened last year, higher oil prices drive inflation higher. And think about it, Chris, it's a tax on the economy. You and I are paying more at the gas pump. Transportation costs go up. Consumers are paying more at the gas pump, so they have less money to spend, let's say, elsewhere. Interest rates could also rise as they did last year, as oil prices and interest rates went up alongside of each other. Although Jonathan Krinsky and I talked about that in the first hour, that isn't really happening right now. So right now, we have rising oil prices and rising interest rates in treasuries. But right now, the 10-year treasury is only up about 20 basis points. So it's not up by much, given the fact that oil prices are up, now check this out, 54% from their December lows. So in many ways, this is sort of a shock to the economy. But as the spread between the 2 and the 10 curve is not much of a rise, basically right now, and who knows, and I tend to lean more towards the bond market than I do the stock market. But at the moment, the interpretation coming from the bond market is that it views higher oil prices as a tax on consumption and not as a harbinger of inflation.
Now, Jim, in the past, I've heard with various guest experts we've had on the show, I've heard you bring up the Straits of Hormuz. What about Iranian political threats to shut down the straits?
You know, I'm not saying it would happen, but that would be the equivalent of an act of war against the U.S. and its Gulf allies. I mean, they may not do that, but they could, for example, they could mine the narrow straits, which sees probably 15 million barrels a day, or roughly 50% of the world's crude consumption, pass through those narrow straits. The Iranian Navy also has a presence there, so they could simply mine the straits, especially in the narrow shipping lanes, which are only 2 miles wide. They could threaten, which could spike oil prices short term, but I don't think it is a real possibility, as it could send oil prices into the triple digits and start a full-scale war between the U.S. and its allies, which would crush the Iranian state. Now, setting mines and threats is the more likely scenario because the sanctions are starting to work against the mullahs in Tehran. The real risk here is that the Middle East, and this is something that, you know, I don't see in too many places, but the Middle East is getting closer to another war as political alignments change, as the U.S. is withdrawing from the region, Iran is moving politically and militarily towards becoming a hegemon.
Well, let's get into that then, because that clearly sounds very serious. If war becomes an issue, I imagine oil prices would just go way beyond $80 a barrel.
You know, right now, you have Iran leading a new bloc with Turkey and Qatar with the intent of reshaping the Middle East. I mean, if you take a look at what's happening in the Middle East, the fall of many regimes, Saddam Hussein, Omar Gaddafi, and Libya, the consequences could lead to a regional war in the region. We haven't had one in decades, but there's a distinct possibility that we're getting close to one. Right now, Iran is exploiting, for its own power advantage, fratricidal wars in the region, mainly in Syria and Iraq. In addition, you have great powers in the region, the U.S., Russia, and China. So you now have great powers involved in the region. Sounds like the great game of the 19th century. But the major players, such as Turkey, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, are also moving and positioning themselves politically and militarily in the region. You have military leaders, for example, recently there was a conference between the key military leaders of Iran, Iraq, and Syria, working together in a military alliance. What they want to do is integration of their air defense systems that could possibly thwart a U.S. or an Israeli warplane attacks. Russia is also a player in Syria. Basically, nothing happens in Syria without the Russians. So Iran is also building a new railway in an international highway system so it could transport weapons and troops into the region ahead of a possible breakout or conflict it alone could initiate. They're also moving settlers into the region, building up what they call Persianization of areas of interest. They're building, Chris, literally neighborhoods populated with Iranian citizens. These new Persian settlements are playing a key role in Iran's financed reconstruction of Syria. And that's one of the reasons why the U.S. is trying to choke off oil revenues from Iran, because this is what they're using. They're using it for a military buildup. And that is Iran. You also have Turkey, which wants to wipe out the Kurds or the PPK. Iran is intent on overthrowing the Saudi monarchy and feels that the Saudi royal family is vulnerable as they are fomenting unrest in the country. At the same time, they're making preparations for war by building a transportation system, both in rail and highway, at the same time coordinating their air defense systems against a possible U.S. or Israeli attack. In addition to that, at the same time, you have a cold war between the Russians and Iran for control of Syria. That face-off is now escalating. The only restraint, and who would have thought of this, in the area is China, which is working on building its Silk Road system into the region. And, of course, China wants to protect its infrastructure investment. So right now, all the main powers are posturing to exploit the dynamics in the region in order to improve their positions in what we call the post-crisis Middle East, where we've seen many regimes get replaced from Saddam Hussein to Omar Gaddafi. The U.S., at the same time, is withdrawing from the region. And whenever a great power withdraws from the region, whether it was Britain from the Middle East at the end of World War II, you have a power vacuum, and now you have these major players. Three major players. You have China, Russia, the U.S., Turkey, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. So the only restraint right now is China. Now, what is happening, and this is what we don't know, is U.S. sanctions are hurting. So sometime during the periods of economic duress, Chris, regimes go to war. So regional tensions are building, with one bloc being formed by Iran, another by Turkey, and another one by Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. Then throw in the great powers, the U.S., Russia, and China.
Well, this is complicated. I want to play a clip that I think will bring some light.
The Middle East is one of the most complex regions in the world. Currently, there are four failing states and three wars, with major powers increasingly taking opposite sides. Countless armed militias and terrorist groups are spreading violence across borders. The region has seen conflict after conflict going back well into the 20th century. But among all the uprisings, civil wars, and insurgencies, two countries always seem to be involved: Saudi Arabia and Iran. They're bitter rivals, and their feud is the key to understanding conflicts in the Middle East. The Saudis and Iranians have never actually declared war on each other. Instead, they fight indirectly by supporting opposing sides in other countries and inciting conflicts. This is known as proxy warfare, and it's had a devastating effect on the region. Countries, especially poor ones, can't function if there are larger countries pulling strings within their borders.
Both the Saudis and the Iranians see these civil wars as both tremendous threats and also potentially enormous opportunities.
The Saudi-Iranian rivalry has become a fight over influence, and the whole region is a battlefield. It's why the rivalry is being called a Cold War.
By the way, that clip is 10 minutes long, but it's an excellent piece if you want to understand many of the possibilities for an approaching war in the Middle East that Jim just covered. It's on YouTube. It's called The Middle East Cold War Explained. But the immediate impact, Jim, is that oil prices are heading higher, and that's just going to impact economic growth in the second half of the year, just at the time where most of Wall Street is expecting a pickup in the economy. So how does this play out in the investment markets? Do you think, Jim, that we might see a repeat of Q4 of last year?
You know, we could if the price of oil spikes and stays there long enough like it did last year. Remember, it started rising, I think it was around $50 a barrel last May. Here we are, we're not quite into May, we're in the mid-60s. So this is what makes this a real difficult call, is geopolitics are really hard to predict. I mean, who would have predicted last November that Trump would have granted waivers as he did? What the bond market is telling us right now, the most likely impact will be a growth slowdown rather than, let's say, a big whiff of inflation as we saw last year. But the higher prices go, and I do see them going higher, the bigger the toll on the economy. The biggest risk is what happens as we head into the fall, as the last of the stimulus plays out in the U.S. And the president, you know, Chris, has to be mindful of what higher gas prices or a lack of resolution on the trade war with China does to the economy and his re-election chances. There's a lot riding in this market on the fundamentals improving. So what if they don't? So far, stock prices are moving up, not on fundamentals, but PE multiple expansion. Simply put, investors are willing to pay more for a dollar's worth of earnings. So Wall Street and investors are betting on a second half recovery. And the question is, what happens if it doesn't happen due to, let's say, political infighting in Washington, as we don't see the Democrats cooperating with the president on anything? It's sort of investigate instead of legislate. So it's very, very doubtful between now and, let's say, November 2020, you're going to see Congress pass major stimulus for the economy.
So from an investor's point of view, Jim, how do you play this out?
You know, you heard Jonathan Krinsky in the first hour. He probably thinks the biggest catch-up in the different sectors within the market is probably in the energy sector. In other words, very much like last year, the price of the commodity has moved up far faster than, let's say, the energy stocks. The result, you're seeing M&A activity. You had Chevron just bid for Devon Energy. Then you had Occidental coming in, increasing its bid over Chevron by 20%. I still like the energy sector. It remains undervalued compared to the rest of the market. And if you think of who benefits from higher oil prices, well, you guessed it, it's the energy sector. Just as last year, higher profits for energy companies, as the price of oil rose, it is doing that now. And prices are higher than where they were last year at this time. I mean, if you just take a look at some of the profits some of these big guys have been reporting, they've been incredible, and they were a major contributor to the increase in profits last year besides the tax cuts. But PE multiples are lower than the market multiples. You have far more upside for higher dividends. Exxon just increased its dividend 6% this year. And the earnings growth is grossly undervalued when you compare the energy sector to other sectors known for income, such as utilities. Let me give an example. Jonathan talked about, you know, the yield proxies that are going on, because basically all sectors of the market are going up except for healthcare. And we'll have more to say about that in the second part of the big picture. But the Dow Jones Utility Average has a PE multiple of 24.3, a dividend yield a little over 3.1. Not much better than what you can get in a 30-year treasury. Now, if you compare that yield to many of the companies of the majors in mid-tiered companies, the dividend yields range anywhere from 4 to 6%. They're growing at a far greater rate than utilities, not to mention selling at much lower multiples with higher growth rates. If you believe energy prices are heading higher and will remain relatively high over the next few years. Another thing, also, if interest rates rise, let's say as a result of higher oil prices and inflation, utilities would be at risk as they were last year. They've gone sideways since the yield on treasuries has risen over the last couple of weeks. So it might be a better opportunity to play a rise in oil prices to be in energy versus utilities. The only problem that we have here, it is not predictable in terms of what happens politically, as so much of what is happening here is driven by politics. OPEC's supply response, Iran's response, Russia, Venezuela, Libya, or even the president's response is what just happened this week with a very abrupt change in announcement on waivers. In fact, this week, the president reportedly spoke with the leader of the Libyan National Army. The key is that leader controls the oil in Libya. So you have all of these moving parts and dynamics that could change politically, but in the short run, we're still bullish on oil and have been despite what happened to oil in the fourth quarter of last year.
So summing up here, Jim, you think oil prices are heading higher, and that's one of the risks that you've mentioned in previous shows, but you also think that if they do, we could see an impact on the economy, and that would cause a slowdown. But as you expect oil prices to head higher, you like investing in the energy sector. You believe it represents an opportunity. But like making any investment, folks, do your own homework and make sure that it aligns with your risk tolerances.
Volatility is back. The stock markets are pivoting, and experts are predicting another recession. How will your retirement weather the storm? Are your investments fortified? Do you have a consistent source of income? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help you answer these questions and plan for the unpredictable. We monitor the markets, interest rates, and the economy so you can focus on doing the things you enjoy most. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Start planning, stop worrying, and make the most of your retirement. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
One of the tenets of this program is that there are three factors that drive markets: the fundamentals, technical, and geopolitics, or politics. Never before have we seen a greater influence on financial markets than in the last financial crisis and the subsequent recovery. And whether it was bailouts of the banking system, trillion-dollar stimulus packages in 2009, and then again in 2018 and 2019, or Fed QE to now presidential tweets, government is getting larger and its influence and policies can move markets as never before. The reason that we're going to cover this topic today is that we've begun a presidential election cycle with both parties offering a different version of government's role in the marketplace. One side wants more government intervention relating to the economy. The other side is more free market. The policies espoused by candidates and what they would do, it really has the power to move markets. And we want to talk about that on this segment. A good example, by the way, of this, there appears to be a swell in Democratic candidates that want to move toward socialized medicine, whether it's Medicare for all or a single-payer health system or a government takeover completely of the U.S. healthcare system. It's having an impact on the financial markets, in particular healthcare stocks, which have just gotten battered, and the one sector within the S&P 500 that's doing poorly this year. And even our technician, Jonathan Krinsky, pointed out in the first hour to that effect. So given the fact that we are in a presidential cycle when, you know, you see politicians kissing babies and handing out lollipops, expect some sharp turns, downdrafts, greater volatility in the markets. And we saw that in Q4 of last year, where a hawkish Fed and presidential waivers on Iran influenced the markets and drove prices into negative territory, just as they are driving up markets this year by a change and turnaround in policy and position.
Yeah, it's one of the aspects of this economic recovery, Chris, has probably been the most difficult to navigate, I would say, in almost four decades in the business. And that's because the role of government, either from massive fiscal stimulus, as we saw in 2009. I mean, think about it. 2009, we got fiscal stimulus of $1 trillion, and we got QE of $1.2 trillion. Fast forward to 2018, we got a $1.5 trillion tax cut. In addition to that, they increased spending by $300 billion over 2 years. And take a look at monetary policy. I mean, when you think about it, over this recovery, which has been about 10 years, seven of those years, they kept interest rates at 0%. And think of the massive amounts of quantitative easing, where the Fed's balance sheet went from closer to $800 billion all the way to $4.6 trillion. Now, I want to illustrate this point. And I want to cover the last 2 years and going forward the next 18 months with this presidential election cycle. I want to begin with last year. We began the year with a $1.5 trillion tax stimulus. That kicked the economy into high gear, plus $300 billion of additional spending. And on top of that, cutting the corporate tax rates from 35 to 21, we got corporate profits rising at 25% per quarter. The result, stock markets headed into record territory. Economic growth picked up to the highest level in 10 years, and we're still at that level. And just about every single asset class made money. Then in May, the administration backed out of Obama's Iranian deal and said oil sanctions would go into effect November 5th. The president tweeted urging OPEC to ramp up production to make up for the shortfall, which they did. Oil prices rose in the near term. Stock markets soared as a result of increased economic growth and double-digit profits due to tax cuts. Interest rates rose along with oil prices, and the stock market headed up with some of those FANG stocks reaching trillion-dollar market caps. Then what happened? The Fed began to get more hawkish. It began in June when they said, well, maybe three rate hikes. We're thinking of four now. And they announced that in their FOMC press conferences, hinting it was far from ending its rate-raising cycle, and QT was on automatic pilot. They began to get really hawkish last September and carried that forward into December when they raised rates for the fourth time and basically said everything was on automatic pilot. Then, of course, came the Trump granting of waivers on Iranian oil sanctions. The result was what we saw between October and especially accelerate in November into the end of the year. Markets and commodity prices plunged, and we ended up with a negative year for the markets. Now, if you would have tried to predict this at the beginning of the year, the economy was strong, corporate profits were up double digits, I don't think anyone would have predicted the way we ended up at the end of the year.
Well, I would agree. I don't think anyone could have predicted that. Jim, let's fast forward, though, to this year. It's starting out pretty much like last year. Instead of a hawkish Fed, we have a dovish Fed. And instead of extending waivers, the waivers will end next month in May. In Washington, the Mueller report seems to be consuming legislators. We now have stock prices at record levels. But as we began this segment, and by the way, you've commented on this with previous programs, we're at the beginning of silly season. It's just over 500 days till the presidential election. And if the future is anything like the past, it could deliver more uncertainty to the market, just as it has to healthcare stocks in the last few weeks.
Well, let's look at how this year has unfolded. We began with the Fed pivot in January, where they said, well, maybe we'll hold back for a while. And then in March, basically, they came out saying no more rate hikes this year, with the futures market now predicting rate cuts by the end of the year. We also have oil prices rising far ahead of where they were last year at this time, thanks to OPEC cuts, rising demand, shrinking supply as a result of sanctions against Iran and Venezuela. If you're a Californian, you're almost looking at $5 gasoline, and I think the national average is well over $3. The markets are in record territory as they are now, and it isn't because of corporate profits rising double digits. It's because investors are willing to pay more for a dollar of earnings. But not everything is rosy, as Mark Chandler and I discussed in Hour 1, when it comes to emerging markets growth, or you take a look at Europe, where interest rates are mostly negative. One wonders if they get into a recession, what their central banks will do. But once again, politics are at play here, from Brexit to the recent calls by leading candidates to end private health care, replace it with government-run health care. And almost all Democratic candidates are calling for a single-payer or government-run health care system, which is impacting health care stocks, which have tumbled. But if you look at where that's going compared to just about every single sector within the S&P is going up. I don't care if it's interest rate plays like REITs, utilities, consumer staples, just about every sector has been going up. Kind of reminds me, Chris, back of what's happening to healthcare now. Back to 1994, they were calling it Hillary Care, just as they're calling it Bernie Care now. Healthcare stocks tumbled in a year before the election by almost 30 to 40%. I remember that very well because I was buying them when they were down about 25 and 30%. Much to my chagrin, they went down another 10, 15%. The same thing could happen to energy stocks, for example, if the Green New Deal becomes part of the Democratic platform, which calls for a takeover of the country's energy system. There's a call for much higher tax rates of up to 70%, annual taxes on wealth, all kinds of market-unfriendly programs. Unfortunately, the presidential campaign is going to influence the markets in a much greater way as we get closer to the actual election, where we have, let's say, a front-leaning candidate, and we have party platforms that will emerge from next summer's conventions. And I can't think of a wider gap between the philosophy of both candidates and parties going forward into this presidential election.
The other thing that strikes me, Jim, and you and Mark Chandler discussed this in Hour 1, no one expects inflation to rise. And it's expected that the Fed will be cutting interest rates by the end of the year. But what if that doesn't happen? Let's say it doesn't. Could we see a reversal as we did last fall?
Well, I mean, take a look at what happened last year. As oil prices began rising, CPI picked up, and along with it, interest rates. We also have, as Mark and I talked about, the dollar keeps rising as it's doing now. Well, that's going to impact corporate profits because 40% of S&P companies get their sales from overseas. A rising dollar means lower sales. Inflationary costs are also rising because as the price of energy rises, as it is doing now, whether it's diesel or gasoline, it's going to affect everything. It's going to affect, for example, the new 2020 international provision on calling lower diesel emissions on all transportation ships. That's going to raise the cost of diesel. So far, it hasn't impacted the bond market as it did last year. But Chris, that too can change. And I suspect this year could be a repeat of last year if this trend continues into the fall. But silly season is going to have a greater influence on the markets the closer we get to the election, and we have a front runner that emerges on the Democratic side. I'm calling this presidential cycle the lots of free stuff that other people pay for cycle. And the best example of this is healthcare, where promises are being made for Medicare for all or the end of private medical care. What got little press coverage this week was the Social Security and Medicare Trustees Report, a topic that we'll be covering on next week's Lifetime Income Show. The trustees report that Medicare Part A, that's the hospital part of Medicare that you don't pay for, will be depleted and run out of money by 2026. Social Security and Medicare, now here's the good news, they will be forced to reduce benefits by 25% by 2035. Now, originally it was 2033, but the trustees said because of more people working, paying into the system, and the economy growing, that date has been postponed by 2 years from 2033 to 2035. And here's another thing that will go into effect next year. Medicare premiums are going to be going up 6-7% for upper income Americans. And if we do get a single healthcare system, folks, it isn't going to be free. And Social Security and Medicare taxes will either have to be doubled or tripled based on income. If the system is going broke now, what happens when it becomes mandatory and available for everyone? It's estimated at Medicare for All will cost $33 trillion over the next 10 years, and the Green New Deal would cost $93 trillion and completely transform the American economy. Nobody's paying much attention to these things now. They generally don't, other than perhaps the impact that it's having on healthcare stocks. But it will become more important as we go forward. This is going to make the job, Chris, in my opinion, for investors more difficult, just as it did last year, and especially as we get closer to the elections. The one thing that markets are not set up for right now, and you hinted at it, is a return of inflation and the Fed to reverse course and start talking about raising interest rates rather than lowering them. Although, here's the one thing. I think the risk of Fed rate hikes diminish as we head into next year. The Fed generally tends to stay on the sidelines during election years, much as the Yellen Fed did in 2016. They talked about raising interest rates at the beginning of the year, but they waited till December after the elections were over.
I think the point you're making here is that politics is going to have a greater sway over the investment markets as we look at the months and years ahead. We're full swing into a presidential election. And the truth is, President Trump wants a second term, and he'll point to low unemployment, strong economic growth, and rising wages. Those are things that voters look at. Democrats will emphasize that the American economy isn't working for all, and that it needs to be overhauled. And some will equate that overhaul to government control over the economy, spending programs, and that usually equate to higher taxes. So stay tuned, as we believe that these are the kind of things that will shape markets in the years ahead, where politics, more than fundamentals, will shape the markets. So Jim, what do you see coming up in the weeks ahead?
You know, I see the big thing is we're just finishing out Q1 earnings season. They'll probably come in less than, let's say, year-over-year comparisons. We'll also have economic numbers. We're watching the LEI. Some of them started to tick up. Everybody is betting, Chris, we're going to have a second-half recovery. So in order to do that, we need to see a pickup in all the LEIs across the board that will tell us that the weak first economy was just sort of an anomaly and that things are picking up because that's what the markets are betting on. What if that doesn't happen? So we're going to watch that. We're going to watch oil prices as I believe that we're going to be heading towards $80 Brent, and we'll probably be in the 70s not too shortly as we head into the summer driving season. So all of that will be coming up in the weeks ahead. So on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.